And amen. Thank you. Quick, what's the difference? Quiz. I thought you'd be excited. There's three pictures going to appear. Thank you, Stacey and Caitlin. So, first one is the Sydney Harbour Bridge, completed in 1932. Okay, so there's that one. Okay, then there's this one. Anyone know what this one is? Snowy Mountains. Channel Tunnel. After centuries of trying to keep the French out, we eventually dug a hole so they could come through. But the Channel Tunnel completed in... Well, that happened in 1990. It was opened to be used in 1994. And that's the moment where the workmen broke through. So we've got the Sydney Harbour Bridge, the Channel Tunnel, and the last one, Jerusalem in the time of Nehemiah. And there's... Now, I know that there was no drone photography in 485 BC. So if you're looking at that thinking, what an amazing picture they took before cameras had been invented, obviously it's an artist's impression. And there's the map of what they think Nehemiah's Jerusalem looked like. So, we've got the Sydney Harbour Bridge, the Channel Tunnel, and Nehemiah's Jerusalem. What's the odd one out? Go back to Sydney Harbour Bridge for me. So, they went from two ends, did that, and it missed, did it? Or did it join up? It joined up. So on two ends, it joined up. And the Channel Tunnel? Two ends, it joined up. Although, don't be fooled, friends. This joining up did not happen in the middle. The English had gone a lot further. Because, you know, the French have lunch and stuff, so work is something to do between meals in France. And, of course, Nehemiah's Jerusalem was rebuilt not from end to end or not starting in one place and going all the way around. They celebrated going all the way around, and we'll do some of that next week. But if you read about Nehemiah's walls of Jerusalem being repaired, everyone did a little bit of a chunk all pretty much at the same time. And you can read about that in chapter 3 of Nehemiah. We're going to look at first two chapters today. But even as an engineering feat, I reckon it's quite hard to start a bridge at two ends, build a bridge that big and join it up in the middle. There's quite a lot of maths involved in making sure that actually happens. It would have been pretty awkward if the two halves of a Channel Tunnel had just kind of... wouldn't it? Although, there is in fact a second tunnel, little known fact, for servicing and stuff. So that might have been their excuse. I reckon they didn't plan it, just probably did do that. And Nehemiah's walls, well, there was a question of joining them up, but they put them all together at the same time. And that wouldn't have been an engineering reason for that so much as the practicality, but also the purpose of which they were trying to build. If you're building a defensive wall, you need it to all happen at once, or you've still got weaknesses in your wall. So, Nehemiah, who rebuilt the wall, which is a bit like saying that Sir Christopher Wren built St. Paul's Cathedral, because I'm fairly sure he didn't put one brick on top of another. But lots of people did. Lots of people did the work. Gail's very helpfully already helped us to think about the fact that it's about everyone working together to get the job done. And if you've ever sat through Bob the Builder with small children, you'll know that song. Nehemiah is often used as a sermon basis for unity. And you might be thinking, oh, here we go, another one on unity. It is that, but there's more to it than that. We're going to look through the first two chapters of Nehemiah. So if you've got Bibles, I encourage you to find Nehemiah. He comes after Ezra, which comes after Job, I think, after the Chronicles. Oh, it's before Job. It's about a third of the way through the Bible. But there are contents pages in Bibles. Don't be afraid to use them. They're there for a reason. So if you want to find Nehemiah chapter 1, we will look through some of this. Nehemiah's background, he was serving the king. The king at this point is a Persian king, King Artaxerxes. The Persians had come along and they'd knocked the Babylonians off the top of the pile as the world superpower of the day. Babylon had conquered Jerusalem, and they deported all the people of leadership to Babylon, and they taught them their way of life. And you can read Daniel's story about how that went for some of them, and Ezekiel as well is trying to work out how to do life and faith in exile. Some of the Psalms. And Nehemiah's there, he's a cupbearer to the king. Now that seems like a fairly ordinary job, but if you're serving the king wine, then you're actually a very trusted person, for obvious reasons, because you could be handing the king some poison. So the cupbearer, and if I was the king, I'd want to know the people that were serving my food. Actually, not much changes, does it? If you go to someone's house, you like to know how they use their kitchen, that they clean. Just me then. So the king trusts Nehemiah. It's not just it's a fairly important position. And also, if you're the cupbearer, your place is right next to the king. So I would think you hear a lot of stuff when the king's conferring with his advisors, when there's discussions about policy and matters of state, and when people come with important requests. I think the cupbearer knows quite a lot of stuff. Probably knows some of the darker secrets as well. So he's a trusted individual. That's important for our story. So here's Nehemiah. This is basically his memoir. It's a story told through from his perspective. If you read Ezra, the book before it, that's the same story, but told from someone else's viewpoint. Ezra was very much about the spiritual renewal of a nation. Nehemiah was about the political renewal of the nation. So let's start reading. The words of Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah. In the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, one of my brothers, Hanani, came with certain men from Judah. And I asked them about the Jews that survived, those who had escaped the captivity, and about Jerusalem. They replied, "The survivors there in the province who escaped captivity are in great trouble and shame. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been destroyed by fire." The first thing that happens in Nehemiah is establishing the objective. See, this is a story of unity. It's a story of people working together, but it's a story of people working together on a defined goal, a particular purpose. As Nehemiah listens to his brother share the news of Jerusalem, God places it on his heart that there's a particular task for him to do. Unity is at its strongest when it's around a particular task or purpose. It's good to be together, it's good to do things together, it's good to have things in common, but we do our unity best when we do it around particular issues. We do it best when we do it around prayer, when we do it with our eyes fixed upon Jesus, as we've already thought this morning. One of there's many highlights in a working week here, and those of you that get to spend some of your week here for various reasons. I hope you catch on to some of the great things that happen. One of the things that's become very important to me and others is our Monday morning. We start with a prayer meeting for anyone who works here. So we've got a fairly regular gathering. Staff come from the ISIS team, from Money Care, and it's just a really good time. And if you're volunteering here on a Monday morning, you know people are often busy, but you're very welcome to come to that prayer meeting. We start the week with that prayer, and we've discovered as we've done that, it's built our sense of unity as a service together. It's a good time to talk about our weekends, where you know we worship in different places. What did God do when we were worshiping with our particular church family? And it comes together. And then we're thinking about what's in the diary for each of us this week. And then we're praying about things that are concerning us. We're celebrating things together. And there's a growing sense of unity in this place as we try to work out how best to serve our community. And we're all involved in that. I know for practical reasons that not everyone can be here on a Monday or any other day of the week for that matter. Some of you have got jobs and other things to do, and I get that. But we're still involved in this shared activity of proclaiming the good news about Jesus in our community. Wherever you happen to be, wherever I happen to be, that's what we're about. No one has yet made an improvement on the church's mission statement as given to us by Jesus to go into all the world and make disciples. It's about bringing people to faith, bringing people to holiness through discipleship. The common objective of building God's kingdom. And sometimes we fall into the trap of thinking that we're the ones who are doing the work, but we're not. He's the one who does the work. But he calls us to play our part. Establishing the objective, establishing what it is we're about, and reminding ourselves about basic things. You see, building a wall around a city is a very basic thing to do. In the ancient world, if you didn't have a protective wall around your city, you would not be there very long. And Jerusalem knew all about that. They've been conquered that many times before and since, actually. The wall that's there now isn't the one that Nehemiah built. It's been rebuilt several times. If you haven't got a defensive wall, you haven't got a city. It's a basic task. Our tasks sometimes in the Christian church are basic tasks, or they seem that way. Nothing is actually wasted in God's economy. But establishing what it is we're about and what we're for, what we're here to do, getting a sense that it's going beyond handing out the food parcel and actually having a conversation with the person receiving it, trying to understand why people come over and over and over again for assistance. Recognizing that it's God's work that we're doing even in the most ordinary and mundane tasks. Nehemiah establishes his objective. And then his first response is this, picking up from verse 4. When I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days, fasting and praying before the God of heaven. I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps covenant and steadfast love with those who love him and keep his commandments, let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer of your servant that I now pray before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. Confessing the sins of the people of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both I and my family have sinned. We have offended you deeply, failing to keep the commandments, the statutes, and the ordinances that you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses. If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though your outcasts are under the farthest skies, I will gather them from there and bring them to the place to which I have chosen to establish my name. They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great power and your strong hand. O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give success to your servant today and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. At the time, I was cupbearer to the king. And then we go on into chapter 2. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was served to him, I carried the wine and gave it to the king. And then the conversation happens. Now, you may have read that lots and lots of times. Nehemiah's prayer is significant in several ways. Firstly, because of what it contains. Initially, it's his own prayer of repentance. He's about to embark on this great task to which God has called him, but he comes to that task with his own sense of lack of worth, his own spiritual poverty. Jesus teaches in the Sermon on the Mount that the blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who know their need of God. Blessed are those who recognize that they are spiritually impoverished. Whatever you and I have been called to do, that's always our starting point. Recognizing our own need of Him, recognizing our own spiritual poverty. Nehemiah doesn't start with, please help me build this big wall. He starts with, please fix me. And whatever God is calling you to do, I want to suggest that's the same for you and for me. Thank you for the calling of this great task or small task or whatever task it might be, Lord. But before I embark on fixing that, will you fix me? I think that's important for the Salvation Army because we're about fixing people. And sometimes we go headlong thinking, we know the answer to this person's problem. We know what their life is all about. We study the processes of addiction and the recovery, and we know about that stuff and the science that we work with and research that we work with, and we know how to do stuff and we know how to engage people in all sorts of ways. We get taught that stuff. And sometimes we can go headlong into the task and forget that we are also a broken child of God that needs fixing. The starting point is, Lord, fix me. And then help me to do that. Nehemiah's prayer is also for the people to whom he's going to go, the people he's going to assist. But there's something that I have to confess I missed in the text until I read it again this morning. You get a impression when you read this that Nehemiah gets this news, he prays, and he goes into the king and says, can I get some permission to go fix this problem? Actually, time passes. A significant amount of time passes. Months pass. We go from, I think, autumn to spring between chapters 1 and 2. This prayer of Nehemiah is, and it says in the text actually, made day and night. Nehemiah is persistent in this prayer. He doesn't set out on the mission until he's completely soaked the whole enterprise in prayer. And again, I need that reminder. I know God can do anything, and I know God knows what I want to ask Him. And sometimes we get very perfunctory about that. Yeah, we've prayed about that, so that'll be okay. Now off we go. But actually, God's got a long time to make sense of you and me. And I think He's a lot more interested in the conversation that we have with Him. He knows what we need. He knows the answer. But what He really wants is the relationship. Spend time talking to me about this. Don't just rush into it. The walls will still be there, broken, when it's time to get there. But right now, spend time praying about yourself, praying about that situation, and really seeking after God about that. For an activist movement that we are, sometimes it's good for us just to pause and take time to really seek the Lord about what we're doing. And I think because of the way Nehemiah approaches it, this prayer changes his approach. Because he doesn't go as the guy has come to fix everything. He goes as the guy to say, come on, let's do this together. We're all in it together. He identifies himself with the people who are struggling there. So he establishes the objective. He bathes the whole thing in prayer. He recognizes his own spiritual poverty first of all. Prays for those people. And then gains the support of leadership. Verses 1 to 8 of chapter 2, where he talks to the king. And the king surprises me that the king speaks to the cupbearer. Says in verse 2, the king said to me, why is your face sad, since you're not sick? This can only be sadness of the heart. The king says, what do you request? Then verse 4. So I prayed to the God of heaven. Then I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servants found favor with you, I ask that you send me to Judah so I may rebuild it. Prayer again. But this time, not months in prayer, but that instant kind of prayer. The moment has come. The king wants to know what's the matter. See, why does a king care about how his cupbearer looks and feels? But again, if you're a king of the most powerful empire the world has, I don't think you've got a lot of friends. I don't think you trust people. And if your cupbearer is looking a bit dodgy, I'd be just wanting to check that it's actually okay, because maybe you've got something to tell me about what's in this cup. Friends, don't overlook the importance of being a cupbearer. Sometimes we do. There's a huge amount of power in handing someone hospitality. It's a theme we might return to. So the moment comes, and Nehemiah says he prays first and then acts instantly. But it's still a matter of prayer, and he gets the help of leadership. Now, I know that we like to be a bit cynical about leadership. We've seen it all before, haven't we? 2020 vision, Forward Together, Australia One, there'll be something else at some point. And stuff that we struggle to understand, and why is all this happening? But, you know, a couple of things. Firstly, Jesus loves the church and commands us to do so. So we've got no business running it down. We've got enough problems without bringing it upon ourselves. And secondly, we need everybody in this endeavor. In your newsletter this week, you will find some financial information about our core. We are committing to communicate about that, and we recognize that will spark some conversations, and that's good, because we want to have those conversations. And it will not have escaped your notice that the amount of money we receive in a month doesn't equal the amount of money we spend in a month. And you will know that if this is how you conduct life in your homes, very quickly problems arise. Well, our divisional headquarters have recognised that too. We've been very grateful for various divisional leaders along the way who've helped us out. And divisional commander, as well as Gavin's final gift to us, was to erase the final debt on this property. We're very grateful for that. And this week we had fantastic news that divisional commander Miriam has gifted us all the money that adds up to our overdraft. Yeah, just pause and reflect on that, because that sum of money was $161,000. We've been given a chance for our fundraising to not be about servicing debt, but to build for the future. Now, we should thank God for our mission partners, who don't just hand out that sort of money for no reason, but recognize the challenges we have and some of the costs that we just have because we're here. but want to help us and recognize that actually we're good value for that. We should be glad about that. But also take our responsibilities to try and avoid that happening again, seriously. Nehemiah gained the support of his leadership. We also gain the support of our leaders. That's important. So I thought that kind of fitted in there. I didn't mean to join those things up until I was looking at this text, and that kind of fell for me. So I want to share that in the context of building together, building God's kingdom, working together, and recognizing that our leaders assist us as well. Nehemiah also recognizes he's got opposition, verses 9 and 10, and he's very, very realistic. And he takes stock, verse 11 to 16 of chapter 2. And if the map's still up there, you can get a sense of where Nehemiah goes. It's about 4 kilometers, this walkway that Nehemiah did. So I came to Jerusalem and was there for 3 days. When I got up during the night, I and a few men with me, I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. The only animal I took was the animal I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate, which I think is the one halfway up the right-hand side, just after that yellow line. Past the Dragon Spring to the Dung Gate, and I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that had been broken down, and its gates had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the Fountain Gate and to the King's Pool, but there was no place for the animal I was riding to continue. So I went up by way of the valley by night and inspected the wall. I turned back and entered by the valley gate, and so returned. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest that were to do the work. And then I said to them, "You see the trouble we are in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burnt. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem so we may no longer suffer disgrace." God had put it in Nehemiah's heart to rebuild the walls. Nehemiah took time to survey the scene. He was realistic about the challenges he faced. We need to be realistic about the challenges we face. The challenges we face are obvious. It's difficult to fund ourselves, and we're getting older. Even as you sit here, that is true. We've got some very real challenges, friends. But we are about a bigger task than us. We are about building for God's kingdom. We are about building for God's eternity. The things that you do count for a great deal in God's economy. And it's about recognizing that we do that together, that we all have a contribution to make. Nehemiah surveys the scene, formulates a plan, identifies the people he needs to be involved, and you can read on, and I encourage you to do so, about all the various people that took on a bit of that. Some of them took on a big chunk of wall to build because they could do it. Some of them couldn't do much practically, but they gave some money. Some people made sure that they were safe, the workmen were safe, while they did their work. Everyone had a task to do. And Nehemiah said, "Come on, let's do it together." And that's pretty much where we leave it now. Let's do this, which God has called us to, together. Everyone doing their part. Jesus prayed a unity prayer. He prayed for his disciples then and disciples now. In John 17. And he said to his Father, "I've given them the glory you gave me, so they may be one as we are one. May they experience such perfect unity that the world will know you sent me and that you love them as much as you love me." May we hear, echoing Jesus' prayer for us, experience such perfect unity that the world will know that he has sent us. Lord bless you.